This is Limitless Possibility. I'm Luc Olivier Dumablet.
And I'm Yannick Marianne.
And this week, we're done with the video game series, so we have another topic.
Yeah, this week's topic is Redux and the pursuit for the one true modern application architecture.
Oh, you're speaking about Redux this week.
Yes.
Now I see what you were talking about offline. Good. Before we start, I think we have some follow-up.
Yeah, very briefly. First of all, some people may have noticed that the audio quality was a little underwhelming on the last episode, and that's because we've still been using Ferrite to edit the podcast. Rather, I have been using Ferrite, and I've been having a hard time recently. There have been some syllables and sometimes sentence fragments that just completely disappear into thin air. So I'm not sure what's going on there. We seem to think that it could be a combination of truncate silence and some of the noise gating stuff I'm doing. So we continue to experiment with it, but we may just revert to using a regular audio editor on a Mac for a while until stuff matures on the iOS front. But that's just our little update on how iOS audio editing is coming along for the podcast.
And I think at this time, the only feature missing from Ferrite will be the removing silence from Audacity.
And real noise reduction, because right now it only does gating, which is not what I want.
Okay.
So next up, unfortunately, we're recording a little early this week, so we have no news to report from the PlayStation VR press event this week at GDC, so maybe next episode we will have a ton of follow-up on PlayStation VR. However, this week, there was a big feature on Polygon.com about how the PlayStation VR came to be, so we're going to put a link to that in the show notes, so that if you're super interested in how PlayStation VR became a project in the first place, you can go read that. It's really long and really detailed, and pretty good read.
Also today, Microsoft announced that Xbox Gamer will be able to play against PS4 and PC players via their online services. Though there's kind of a small caveat to it. It will require Sony and other players to participate, quote unquote participate, in order for games to be played across Xbox One and PS4. So let me guess something here. Microsoft is announcing this, and then Sony will be like, nope, we don't support it. And then Microsoft will be able to say like, hey, we're trying to be the good guys. See, Sony doesn't want to support it. And then they'll try to kind of bring that like one versus the other mentality from those core people.
Yeah, that's more or less how I expect it to go.
Yeah.
It seems like it's just like they're giving up on the whole Xbox thing. They're saying, we're trying to move to more of this unified gaming platform that people can be a part of and just try to be a good citizen in the gaming landscape. And I unfortunately don't think it's going to work out very well for them, especially because Steam pretty much has the PC end of things dealt with. And there's no real advantage to PlayStation Network other than goodwill to actually support this cross-network gaming thing. So I don't think it's going to happen, but good on Microsoft for trying, I guess.
Yeah, and maybe I'll end on that. It feels to me that it's kind of part of their new way of thinking, that they want like Microsoft services on every platform. They want it everywhere. Like it's kind of the Windows everywhere without the asterisk that says only on PCs. Good. Hey, wow. Did we do follow up in 5 minutes? Wow. I think we're starting to be good now. I think we're starting to get the grasp of follow-up is not the topic, but I won't jinx it so much, so let's move to your topic.
All right, so this is sort of a mashup between a conversation that we had over coffee during Christmas break and episode 22 on software versioning and flexible app design in the era of cloud services, and it's going to become much more obvious why that is a spiritual successor. So the foundation of the APIs that we use for modern OS X and iOS development were developed in the late 80s at Next, and they were heavily inspired by the early object-oriented programming that Steve Jobs and Apple's engineers saw at Xerox PARC in the early 80s. And the primary paradigm right here is Model View Controller. And while Model View Controller may have seemed like a novel approach to software development back then, a lot of developers recently in the iOS community have expressed frustration with, quote, massive view controller architecture, especially in the iOS scene. And this is basically sparking the pursuit for a modern application architecture. What's the best way to develop applications on modern day platforms? And is that necessarily the most pragmatic answer to the question? So before we go into some of the proposed solutions, I guess we should cover what Model View Controller is for people who are less familiar with development. Although this episode will be quite developer heavy. So if you're not a developer, you might lose us, and we apologize for that, but come back in 2 weeks, I guess.
I was about to say that if you were tired of video games podcast, now we're back to all like, let's talk about code.
Yeah, it's a hard flip. I had to go to the complete opposite extreme. So let's start out with, well, what's a model? Well, models are business logic objects. For a calendar app, for example, this could be calendars, it could be events, it could be time zones, it could be event attendees. You could overgeneralize and call it basically anything that comes from a database or a remote server. Do you agree with that description?
I would say yes.
All right. Next up, view. That pretty much says it right there. It's the display layer. For a calendar app, this might be the collection view that handles displaying all of the various events atop columns representing different weekdays and whatnot. Then there's controller, which gets a little bit more hazy. It has basically two responsibilities, the way I see it. It handles actions from the view to transform the model, but it also transforms the data in the model to something that can be displayed by the view. And adding to this whole confusion is sort of this Apple-specific term called view controllers, which are not really a thing in MVC, they're just this thing that Apple made up, which is a controller for a view which may or may not be embedded in another view owned by a view controller. Now, if you just lost me there, I can basically generalize way too much and say that if you're using an iPhone app, every screenful of information is its own view controller. It's not 100% of the case, but it's good enough to get you understanding what we're talking about when we're talking about view controllers.
Yeah, I think the simplest way of saying it is imagine there's two continents. So you have your model on one side and then the UI on the other side. And then there's a big bridge. But in the middle, to talk to both sides, there's a small island that is able to communicate with both sides and coordinate communication with both sides.
Right, except the criticism that's going up recently is that the island might be a little bit too big between the two, but...
Yeah, it might be its own continent.
Yeah. The frameworks included on iOS and OS X are not only developed with this philosophy, but a lot of the time it assumes that your code adheres to that philosophy as well, which makes it kind of hard as a third-party developer to completely divorce yourself from the idea. But some people actually manage to do it, and it's easier to do it in Swift than it was in Objective-C, I feel. And that basically makes it the de facto default. And it's probably going to be the easiest to find documentation for OS X or iOS apps developed in MVC structure than it is in any other structure. So the issue basically with MVC, as far as the community sees it, and note that I'm not necessarily stating my opinion on this, and yeah. I don't think the community is either.
I think let's not generalize too much, but just say some people part of the community, not the whole community.
No, it's not the whole community, and I think that MVC has been immensely helpful for a lot of the time that these frameworks have existed to structure data correctly. It's not clear if that's necessarily the best way for nowadays. And I think that one of my criticisms of MVC above other suggested solutions is that it's not really a system with strict rules as much as it is a general guideline that you have to follow. And then the problem is everybody sort of interprets those guidelines differently. And then you wind up with massive view controllers. Do you think that's a fair statement?
It is. But at the same time, I would put this flexibility of the design as an advantage. Like it's a positive too at the same time. But yeah. If you don't, not necessarily if you don't know what to do, but more if you're still or used to work in a certain way or like move from, I don't know, from the Windows community or maybe the web development community where there are similar patterns, the way Apple is kind of teaching MVC and the way they taught their own version of MVC is malleable to those other patterns that closely, but not closely resemble to the way Apple wanted MVC to be.
Yeah, and I think that of all of the MVC frameworks I've seen in various languages over the years, I think that Apple's, especially on iOS, is one of the easiest to grasp immediately, especially with the idea of view controllers, which represent about a screen full of information. They really nailed what is the definition of the controller with regards to what it represents visually.
And it's easier because the iPhone originally had a small screen. So it was easy to just say, like, oh, it is a small portion of your application. And it's kind of easier to encapsulate than compared to a Mac application or PC application where you might have more information on screen at the same time.
Or even then, like on the iPad, generally, if you take into account, like, you have a split view controller, which has your two different view controllers on each side of the screen, and then you add, a modal view controller on top of that, you have basically three view controllers on screen on an iPad app. I mean, you can have more because view controllers are embeddable into each other, so technically it's not really 100% of the case, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, this reminds me, a while ago, Federico Vitici was posting a screenshot of how much layers of UI can I get.
Oh yeah, that's iPad ridiculous. App.
So I think it did something like, I'm using split screen, and then I show the control center, and then I have a
picture
couple
of
alert dialogues, picture in picture, popovers, and I think you end up with, 10 different layers of UI on the same iPad?
No, I think it's
iPad?
Like 21 or something. It got really out of control, and his screenshot was basically like nonsense at the end.
It was.
But yeah, so it was really, I think UIKit, especially on the original iPhone, really nailed making MVC accessible to first-time application developers, and I think that it did a really good job of that. But as we said, the criticism is it's way too easy to put all of your stuff in the controller, and it's not really clear if the responsibility for that should go to the developer, who is the one who put all the stuff there, or if the blame should go on MVC itself. I tend to sort of stand in the middle. I think that MVC is not a perfect architecture, and I think that it's very easy to get carried away and see the letters MVC and then go too far. And I've witnessed some of this when I was doing Iconoclasm on jailbroken iOS devices, where at a certain point, Apple basically updated the OS and decided to give way too many things their own models and views and controllers that used to be one class, and it became a nightmare to deal with. But of course, I was reverse engineering the thing, so of course I was only thinking about myself. I didn't really care about their own job internally at Apple.
Obviously it's easier to patch one class than 10, so
exactly. But yeah, so I sort of stand in the middle. Would you like to state your own opinion so we can move on to the next thing?
I would tend to agree that I stand maybe a little bit more on the, can we put it on the left and right scale? Because I love the scale. So what would you put on the left and what would you put on the right?
I don't want this to get politically charged, so I'm not going to say anything.
Okay, but you put one, like, if let's just say that it's mostly like, I'm more like 60% on the side of MVC and 40% on the side of new other technologies, and it's easy to be dismissive of them, and I'll be honest, sometimes I am, because they bring something new to the table and you're just dismissive because it's something new. But at the same time, I'm sure we'll touch on when you try to explain one of them, but it feels to me that they try to make stuff simpler, but in the end, other stuff becomes more complex.
Yeah, it's all about trade-offs, right? I mean, that's going to be the case whatever the next replacement is. I don't think there's a golden solution that magically makes everything better.
You're totally right, but I think in the end, what happens, it feels to me that they fix some problems that I think were not the right one, but not my main gripes. and they broke stuff that I loved.
Okay, that sounds reasonable. So let's move on to the next thing, which is what I use at work. It's sort of what I use at work. It's Model View View Model, which has become relatively popular in the iOS space in the last 2 years or so. I think we've heard about it way, way more in the last 2 years. Would you agree with that?
Oh, totally. And let's be honest for a sec, too. Those patterns, I'm sure, were invented. Like you mentioned, Apple has been using MVC for a while, and those patterns in certain fonts were invented maybe like 10 or 15 years ago, even older than that. It's just that they got new names, so they are the flavor of du jour and all of that stuff.
Yeah, so as far as I can tell, it really got big and popular around the time that Microsoft used it for Silverlight, which is kind of stupid because Silverlight was not exactly a successful technology. But it's still heavily in use in Microsoft circles, and as I said, more recently it sort of burst out onto the iOS scene.
And it's used by Netflix. Don't forget about Netflix.
Oh, sorry, I don't know anything about Netflix tech. So I'm going to give the same kind of high-level overview of what MVVM is compared to MVC. Model, pretty much exactly the same as it is in MVC. It's your standard business logic objects. What's interesting is in MVVM, view and view controller are treated as one atomic unit. So basically, they can be coupled to each other. Who cares? As far as MVVM is concerned, they are one and the same.
Which are named view, if I recall correctly.
Yes. And then there's view model, which is a new object that's introduced between the model and the view to handle all of the non-UI logic. This means preparing data for presentation, network requests, validations. All of this lives in an object that's incapable of touching the UI directly and can be tested more easily, in theory. The UI binds its state to fields on the view model. So, and this is a direct quote, we don't need to test the UI. Wink, wink. That's a big warning sign to me.
Oh my goodness. Obviously, if I bind the text field to the wrong data on the view model, oh, it just works. That's okay. We don't
have to test that. Hashtag, it just works. One of the big issues with MVVM as a philosophy or as a design architecture or whatever is that nobody can agree on what it actually means. So the thing I said is, in theory, what MVVM is supposed to mean. But in practice, basically everyone who uses MVVM has a completely different definition of what it is. And I'm going to start by explaining what the MVVM I do at work is and how it differs from what I just said.
Right. And I've also seen definition where you said like MVVM would say, which is model view view model. I've seen also model view, which is also patterns that I've seen that are closely resemble to what you're about to explain.
And there's also model view presenter, which as far as I can tell is sort of a synonym for MVVM from the older days. I can't really tell the difference between the two reading descriptions of the two, but maybe it's just clearer when you use presenter than view model. I don't know. But let's talk about what I do at work. So our MVVM at work is much more a model for the view approach, where each view gets its own dumb old object with a bunch of fields that we just pass info into. And then the views take that object and handle displaying that information. But basically, it makes sure that the controller doesn't actually know about the subviews of the view, or in our case, the subtemplates or whatever, because we're doing web development. And that is pretty different from the MVVM promise, where you basically put all of your logic that is non-UI into the view model. We basically just treat it as, here's a struct of data to render, which is, I mean, there's some use to that, but I wouldn't necessarily call it model view model, because in the end, a lot of our logic, in fact, most of our logic lies in the controller anyway, which, by the way, the controller still exists because it's bound to the view. So as far as I can tell, it's sort of semantics. It's just we're adding a class here and pretending it's a new thing, but it's not really that new of a thing. It's just you're changing, instead of passing one argument to your view, you're passing several and vice versa.
Let me stop you there.
Yeah.
Let's use a concrete example. Let's imagine I want to show a label that says, for example, phone number. And on its right, I have a text field where I can input my phone number. And to make it simple, let's not do any validation on it. So can you describe the flow of data between all of those objects in your current pattern?
Okay, so the controller is going to fetch the model from the database.
Okay.
Then so, it's going to turn that model into a view model, which is going to have fields that have basically a display name attribute on them. This is because we're doing ASP.NET MVC, which, by the way, the framework is called ASP.NET MVC, but we're using it for MVVM. But yeah,
not so, confusing at all.
So in ASP.NET MVC, fields on objects can have what are called display names, which basically represent what the label should be for that thing. So I would set the display name to, let's say, phone number,
which came from the database.
No, it can. It's just like some property on the object. It doesn't come from the database necessarily.
Okay, I wanted to make it clear.
Okay. Then I'm going to take that view model and pass it to the view, which is capable of rendering the fields in the view model. And it's going to basically just throw the... It knows from the type of the field if it should be a text field or whatever, because there's also another attribute you can put on things called UI hints. But by default, let's say the editor for a string is going to be a text field. The editor for a Boolean is probably going to be a checkbox and stuff like that. So I would just use editor for the name of the field, and it would render that in the HTML when you go to the page.
Okay, good. I wanted to make sure that I was understanding the same thing you explained. So an example is also good for that.
But the thing is, like, that example is sort of a bad example because there's only one field. So in that case, it would make no difference if I pass a view model with one field or just set the one field directly into the view, right? But
right.
Normally you would have a very complex form, for example, with maybe 90-something fields, unfortunately. not that I've had to do that, like, recently. And then in that case, well, yeah, you're passing one object over to the view instead of manually setting all of these properties across the whole place. And, of course, there's some convenience in doing that thing with ASP.NET MVC, because since it can automatically determine the right kind of field for us, the correct kind of input element for the field that you're using. So a date is going to have a date picker if you're using a richer framework like we are, stuff like that. Then you can save a lot of time by basically just having same defaults determined by the types that you have. The problem is I just don't think the benefit is necessarily there to do lightweight MVVM. That's what I'm going to call it, lightweight MVVM, where your objects are effectively the dumbest objects on the planet. I don't see very much benefit. All you're doing is changing where all your setters go from in the view to in another object, but you're still writing like 50 set statements one after the other. You're just not writing them at the same place.
And I would say same regarding some of those network call you mentioned when you explained the view model and all. It feels that the main downside from this pattern is you moving your massive view controller into another object. So your view controller becomes small, but all of the complexity from the massive view controller went into another object. So you didn't solve the problem. You just moved the problem.
Right. Well, if you actually did anything in there, what you did do is you manage to slim down your view controller to only have to deal with view-related things, which is an improvement, of course, except you've still got this junk drawer class lying around, and it's your view model and has basically everything in there that you still have to deal with. And some people have suggested breaking that down into even more classes, and I tend to agree. The problem is, certain point you have to basically decide, is it really worth splitting all that stuff into different classes? If it's a particularly complex system, I can see it being actually worth it. But if you're doing a relatively simple thing, who cares? You can basically put it all in the view anyway and not care too much about single responsibility principle and stuff like that. But I think we've established pretty well that MVVM basically is a term that has no concrete definition. It is even worse than MVC in terms of being a general guideline and not being a strict system, because at least MVC, people have a general agreement of what it means, but MVVM, nobody can agree on what it means literally. And there's even also a lot of argument about whether a view model should be mutable or immutable, if it should be a class or a struct in Swift terms. And ultimately, the lack of consensus on what makes MVVM MVVM is what makes it really hard to find any kind of coherent documentation on it. And it tends to become, like view controllers, a massive overbearing object with no clear boundaries of what does and doesn't belong there. I guess we should also mention this other thing, which is specific to iOS and OS X, which is MVVM seems especially common alongside reactive extensions, such as Reactive Cocoa or RX Swift. On .NET, that would be just plain old RX, because that's where it came from. And that has its own set of problems. I don't like to shit on functional reactive programming, because I think that it's an actual good and interesting paradigm.
But you're about to do it.
Well, no. The problem I have with those extensions is one that I've covered in the past, which is it's a big third-party dependency that if you build your app on that and suddenly Reactive Cocoa breaks, what are you going to do? Your entire app is basically unusable. You have to start all over again and write it either against another reactive extension thing that works or just rewrite it in MVC again. And I think that heavy-handed approaches like that, where you basically adopt a new paradigm that is entirely dependent on this third-party library, is not a great idea for ensuring the survival of your application into the future.
Yeah, and hopefully for you, it's not one from Facebook, because they will already have written the third new version of it.
Well, speaking of that...
I knew you were going there.
Let's talk about Redux, which is my new BFF.
From Facebook?
Well, no, not really. It's kind of. It comes out of the React community, but it's not actually by Facebook. So, Redux by itself is a 2-kilobyte JavaScript library written by Dan Abramov, which, yes, has been hired by Facebook, but he wrote it before he was at Facebook. That is sort of a mashup between two software architectures. There's Facebook's Flux, which is basically non-existent now because it has been replaced with Redux basically everywhere it was used, almost. Except in production at Facebook, of course. Which is used in React.js, which is the development the view layer framework we have mentioned in the past on episode 22. And it's also a mashup with model view update architecture used in the Elm programming language, which you probably have never heard of.
I've never heard of it.
Yeah. It's incredibly lightweight, which is out of the norm for modern day JavaScript, where everyone tries to make the most ridiculously bloated, giant developer tool required thing in the world. Sorry, Node.js fans.
Do I dare to say it? Oh, I will. Please email Yannick. Please do.
So let's explain more or less what Redux is. This might seem a little strange at first, but then again, so did React.js. So please take that into account while listening to it. I think at the very least, it's a very interesting approach, if anything else. So the entire state of your application, yes, the entire state of your application lives in what is called a store, a single read-only source of truth. The only way you are allowed to modify the store is through actions you dispatch to it. Actions are basically a noun and a payload. The payload can contain literally anything you want. When the store receives an action, it goes through a function called a reducer. It's a pure function, which means that it will always give the same result given the same input. And it takes both the current state and the action as an input, and it spits out the transformed state as the output. And clients can subscribe to be notified whenever the global application state changes, and they can update themselves this way. And the primary benefits of this is, of course, unidirectional flow of data, and the whole thing is immutable. It complements React.js's purely functional approach to the view layer, but doesn't require use of it if you don't want to, which is certainly great because I have no interest in loading all of React.js into my projects necessarily. You might have noticed that none of this has anything to do with iOS, which is true. Except there are two different Swift implementations of Redux that have existed over time, Swift Flow and Redux Kit, which have since been merged into ReSwift, which is a terrible name for a framework, but whatever.
Yep. I heard of it. Do you want to know a funny story?
Yeah, sure.
Last week at Cocoa Heads Montreal, somebody did a talk about ReSwift.
Oh, nice.
So that's why it made me laugh when you said that you were about to talk about Wii Flux.
Well, I wasn't actually thinking that far. The original Redux developer, as we've mentioned, now works on the React team at Facebook. And because of that, it now has support for React Native applications on iOS and Android. So if you don't actually want to develop in Swift, but if for some crazy reason you want to develop in JavaScript instead, you can do that. I think there are a lot of cool side effects from this architecture. So the first thing is, if your state is serializable, you should get state restoration for free, unlike what iOS has promised for years now, and nobody has ever gotten to work right. You can preserve the entire timeline of actions and states in your application and replay them for debugging purposes, which is really interesting, I think. And on top of that, if you introduce code hot swapping using something like Webpack or a similar extension, you've got a real-time development environment, which is incredibly compelling. For a video of this, you can go watch the introduction of Redux when he originally introduced it at React Europe, I think, where he basically debugs a React application in real-time within the browser and changes stuff in real-time, and it hot-swaps the code and everything, and it's really impressive. Not all of that is possible on iOS, naturally, because hot-swapping is a lot harder when you're dealing with compiled languages and the limitations imposed on iOS, but
I've seen something regarding that recently. Oh crap, I forgot the name. But I've seen a new tool/service that would provide you not hot swapping, but I think it's like over the air patches of your binaries on iOS.
Yeah, I've seen certain things like that. We mentioned App Hub on episode 22, which was basically that idea for React Native applications. I'm not aware of anything that does that at the Swift or Objective-C level, because as far as I'm aware, it's against the App Store terms and services. But maybe for like enterprise apps, it actually works.
Yeah, and that was my thinking when I saw this news or this web service. Is like, how can this be on the App Store apps? But it seems to work.
Interesting. So because all of your non-UI logic is supposed to be spread as to be in those reducer functions, in theory, it should make it much, much easier to test your app's logic, because there's much, much stricter separation between it and your UI code. It's, I feel like it's a stricter system than something like MVVM, where in theory, you're supposed to have in the MVVM I described anyway, you're supposed to have all of your non-UI code in that class. Of course, the thing that immediately comes up is, wait a second, there's one function that is handling every action in my application. How can this possibly scale? And I echo some of those concerns, of course. But you can actually compose, reducers from other reducers. So every individual system can have its own reducer, which is part of a larger reducer, and there is actually a function called combine reducers, which automatically does this for you and creates a pipeline of reducers which handles every case and blah blah blah.
Oh, by the way, sorry to interrupt, but I found the name of the service.
Oh, what is
it? It's called rollout.io.
I have not heard of this.
Yeah, it was something new, and it is most like what they say is you do have to have an SDK inside your code base. And you add the SDK, it does smart code analysis, and then you deploy the app to their server, and then you can do live patching of production application using their dashboard. And what they do is they use JavaScript, and then they use the JavaScript core to push a patch. And
except
there's
that only really sounds like it would work for something like React Native, where the entire app is in JavaScript already.
Right. And it says, obviously, the first question in the FAQ is, does rollout comply to Apple guidelines? Obviously, they say yes. They do not modify or alter the binaries. They just only use JavaScript core to add logic to your app updates. And my guess is part of the SDK, they are able to, and part of JavaScript core is they are able to expose all of your object classes from your application through the JavaScript layer. And then when you push a patch using JavaScript, you are able to talk directly to your Objective-C code using JavaScript Core.
Yeah, I can see that being the case, but it doesn't seem like exactly what people would want out of such a system.
Right, and they say later that they do methods, like they do functions as swizzling, because the other question is, would it affect my performance? And then they say, no, it's fine, we just swizzle function and that's it.
All right. Yep.
Yeah, interesting. Sorry about the interruption, but
it's interesting.
It was interesting, but sometimes it's like, huh, that's interesting, but would I buy my startup idea on this?
Nope.
But it seems that somebody are, and hopefully they're going to make tons of cash and their startup is going to grow and Microsoft will buy them with, I don't know, like they did with tons of iOS stuff recently.
Yep.
So back to your Resurf explanation.
Yeah. So another cool thing that you can do when basically your entire application logic is handled in a single pipeline is introduce middleware, which is a concept that a lot of people may be familiar with from the Ruby community, where you could use Rack to have middleware between whatever your web application is and the server that you're using. So you could pipe in middleware that would log every object in, not every object, but every action and every state change directly to a console. And in fact, most of the cool and interesting debugger tools are built on top of middleware. It's not really that complicated. And it's quite simplistic a design, I think. Now, one of the things that sounds incredibly cool about Redux in theory is that it sounds like it would go hand in hand with Swift storyboards really well, if Swift storyboards weren't too busy crashing all the time. Because there is actually a class you can go watch on the internet. It's 30 videos with the creator of Redux, who basically introduces you to all of the concepts necessary to develop applications with it. And he does the whole thing inside a JS Fiddle window, which is basically the JavaScript equivalent to Swift storyboards. And I think it would be
really...
I think
he meant Playgrounds, though.
Yeah, not storyboards, Playgrounds. Yeah, sorry. It's been a while since I've been in Xcode.
Yeah, I was like, why is he saying that Swift storyboards are crashing?
Sorry, I screwed up. Well, they also crash, but that's a different thing. So yeah, I think it would go incredibly well for prototyping little sections of your application, let's say. You could do all of that there without any UI and then throw that into your application and then subscribe to the state notifications in your application and just plug it into your UI and have interesting fun.
Oh, and by the way, don't forget that the latest Xcode version supports live interaction of UI in Playgrounds. So you could also work on your UI in those Playgrounds.
But will it crash more if I enable that?
That would be interesting to test.
Yeah. At this point, I'm just very, very reluctant to introduce anything into my Playgrounds, because the chances that it will crash more basically go up a ton as soon as you do anything in them.
Right, you just need to check the let's fix everything, run in the full simulator mode. That's yeah. Always fix everything, right?
Sure, whatever. So I'm going to go through some things I like about Redux and then some things I don't like as much.
Can we skip the thing you like and just go to the stick you don't like?
No,
I'm kidding.
No. Okay, so things I like. At its core, Redux can be implemented in a single function, so it's not like an overbearing framework like, let's say, Reactive Cocoa. And it can be easily implemented in whatever language you happen to be working in. There's even a video lesson in the series that I mentioned where the creator of Redux explains the entire create store function in real time and implements it with the viewer. And explains exactly how it works behind the scenes. And I think that is really cool, because how often do you see approaches of software development that can be encapsulated in a single function? That is just poetic perfection, really. It's a system with strict rules that can be enforced by the programming language you are working in most of the time, instead of a convention or design pattern that is meant to be followed but can be broken at any point in time. This is sort of the point where I think that Redux really... is interesting compared to MVC and MVVM, is these are the rules. If you're not happy with it, then go back to MVC or MVVM land. Of course, it still has to coexist with some sort of MVC framework of some sort, because it's not a complete replacement for everything. It really just handles how data flows from one portion of your application to the other. And I think that that is, in many ways, one of the big problems that these architectures have, is you don't really always know who should be the owner of what in MVC. And this really just sets it. It says, these are the rules for data flow in your application. You will follow them and things should work. Emphasis should on the work. Should. Yes. Okay, now let's get to the things I don't like or am unsure about.
Wow, the positives list was short.
Yeah, but I think, well, we'll get to the conclusion after this. Okay, so things I don't like. Stringly typed actions. This is less of an issue in Swift because it has wonderful enums. But in JavaScript, basically your actions are going to be defined by strings, and stringly typed is not necessarily always the greatest thing. But again, JavaScript type system, lol. That's all I have to say.
I'm sure most of the people that did update CC development has run into that issue where either you want to specify a selector, then you start to just write an S string from selector at selector to make sure that the compiler complains if a selector goes away and not just keep a string, and then everything crashes when you run the application.
Yeah. Yep, and I've had similar problems in C# with razor templates, which are basically the equivalent to the PHP templating language where you just write your code in line, where that does not necessarily always validate what you're typing. So you can run stuff, and if you've made a typo, I might not even complain about it at compile time and just let you blow everything up. Next up in my list of concerns, performance/scaling. Nobody is surprised by this.
Oh my goodness.
When basically every element in your application is subscribing to every single state change in the application, that maybe sort of starts ringing some warning bells in your head.
Also, keeping the old history of states of your application can be a problem too.
Well, that is not the default behavior. That is just if you decide to enable certain kinds of middleware. But yes, I agree. It won't necessarily scale. I mean, the debugging tools and all that stuff don't necessarily scale to a huge application. Generally, though, those tools do allow you to set a subset of what you actually want to observe, which is useful for bigger applications. And the strange thing is, a lot of people are saying that they're using Redux in production in actual real applications that are non-trivial. The problem is you can rarely actually find examples of those, like example code that is non-trivial, and that worries me a lot, because I don't know if they're doing anything to structure their code differently using Redux, or using any particular hacks or whatever to try and get it to scale better. But at an immediate glance, that's the first thing that jumps out at you, is how on earth does this scale? And again, as I said earlier, people said the same thing for React.js, but React.js had an answer to that, and the answer to that was the virtual DOM, where they were, instead of operating directly on the DOM itself, they had a virtual DOM which they would diff, and then only make the changes to the DOM objects that are required, because the DOM is slow as shit. And as far as I can tell, Redux doesn't have any of that, and that worries me a lot. And I'm not sure what to think about it yet. I haven't played around with Redux yet, but I do intend to play around with it either with ReSwift or with Redux in JS, because I do have some other web stuff I want to try out. But performance and scaling is the big mystery. And unfortunately, since this is like an 8-month-old technology or so, I mean, it came out last summer, there's not a lot of people who have actually written a lot of useful documentation on scaling Redux, and that is really a mystery to me. And the last thing is unclear threading concerns. Of course, this is not an issue in JavaScript, because JavaScript is single threaded, of course. Like, this never occurred to anyone that threading might be an issue. And as far as I can tell, ReSwift has no real answer to this either.
I have one for you.
Oh.
You make sure to run everything on the main thread, and then you use one of those Facebook libraries that render UI off thread, off the main thread.
Oh, Oh, well, yeah, no, that totally makes sense. It's also totally not going to happen. Yeah, so, multi-threading, as far as I can tell, there is no solution to this in any language that Redux has been implemented in yet, which is sort of an issue because we're in the multi-threaded age in everything that is not JavaScript. And it would sort of be useful to think in multi-threading terms. And as far as I can tell, no one is even considering it right now. And async is also very confusing as to when you actually need to dispatch your actions and whatnot for it to work correctly. You would think that since JavaScript has a lot of async stuff, that there would be some kind of canonical answer on the JavaScript side that we could adapt into the Swift side of things, but it's sort of really just, yeah, you can dispatch your action if your Ajax call finishes, and if not, well, I don't know.
You dispatch it on a private queue where background thread will try to call your main store while at the same time another thread tries to call your main store and to do an action, and then everything works magically.
I kept trying to draw the diagram in my head of what you just said, and I wasn't able to, so too bad. But yeah,
It was pretty straightforward. Just that somebody tries to update the main store from two threads at the same time. It's working, right?
Sure, whatever. So yeah, that brings me to basically my conclusion, which is I think that Redux is an incredibly interesting idea. I am not 100% convinced that I would use this in production on anything except the most trivial of applications. And judging by the kind of sample code I'm finding on the internet, neither does anyone else. But apparently people are. So that's sort of like the other thing is, yeah, people are saying that they're using this in production and then refuse to show any code sort of proving it. Which is sort of an issue to quell my concerns about Redux as a thing. I think it's a really interesting model. I think that unidirectional data flow is generally a good idea. I think that using functional ideas such as making data mutations a function and making view rendering a function is really, really compelling. I don't think we've necessarily nailed how to express those concepts in the greatest of ways, but it's an idea I'm looking into. And I think that Redux so far is the most elegant way of doing it, except there are still a lot of concerns, as you could hear, with regards to especially performance scaling and threading concerns. Is that more or less what you thought too?
Yeah, kind of. Like, it kind of fits with what I've seen from my research and from talking with people that, yeah, it seems a little bit too magic to me, and it automatically works, and then what about performance, what about multi-threading, what about this, what about that, what about that, and then the list grows and grows and grows
and
grows.
To be clear, I think that it's really great that people are actually experimenting with these kinds of ideas, and I think that the web is a much, much more amenable place to experiment with those concepts, because the web stack is basically a blank slate. You start with HTML, and you can put in JavaScript if you want, but basically there are no rules on the web. You can try basically anything you want and prototype it relatively quickly because JavaScript is relatively quick to develop in. But I think that it's better to have people experimenting with these ideas than basically just putting up with the status quo. And I think that that's something that I do a lot in my life in general, is question the status quo and whether or not people are just doing things because it's tradition, or whether we should push things beyond what they are right now. And I think that it's really interesting to play around with that technology, even though it might not be perfect. And I am probably going to be using Redux in either a website or an application within the coming weeks. But we'll see. I have a bunch of other stuff to do, so I might not get to it. But I really want to play around with this technology because I think that it's in the interest of moving software development forward for all of us to experiment with these things and see what works and what doesn't and what we like and what we don't like, instead of just sticking to the same old tools like certain developers do and just never really evolve until we're forced to move on to the next thing.
Right. And I think I have maybe I wouldn't say less pragmatic approach, but I think it's more on the observer approach for all of those technologies. Is I'm quite open to listening to people that uses them, and also kind of challenged when they say it's magic or it's way better than this, and make sure that also those people are challenged when they say that, because they might have forgot the problem or the project they're working on, it's not a problem they need to solve. So they might say that oh, it's way better than, for example, MVC, but they haven't run into a limitation of that pattern in their current situation, where in my current situation I will run into that problem for that pattern quite a lot. So in my opinion, challenging those people and maybe leaving those people to just like, you want to experiment, go with it. I won't block you. If I will gladly want to talk with you about your experiments and what do you think about those, but be sure that if you start saying stuff like, oh, it's magic, okay, explain to me why it's magic, or it's way simpler than the old way of doing it. It's like, explain to me why are you saying that it's simpler? And I won't say to this day, but in most cases, when people start to say like, oh, it's simple, it does blah, blah, blah. And then, have you thought of this case? Oh, yeah, yeah, it does that. Okay, that's one case. Have you thought of this other case? If this problem happens, how can this pattern solve it better than the old one? And you still find one pattern that I want to be fixed, that is not fixed, while still drawing limitation on stuff that I think current patterns have fixed.
Yeah, and I think whenever you're dealing with either, it's not really a one-to-one, it's not equal one-to-one, but the tools that we're using at work, we're using certain like JavaScript widgets to automatically do date pickers and whatnot like that. And I think that we have a lot of very complicated business logic that is clashing very heavily with that system that were not necessarily concerns that they had when developing their system, because they were developing for lowest common denominator. And I think that that's basically the issue with a lot of frameworks or wider approaches, is that they're very tailored to the application they were supposed to fix, and not so much for every case, because it's impossible to think of every case when you're designing anything. And usually it's always best to choose the best tool for the job instead of just sticking to what is popular or whatever. And I mean, like, recently, I've been working on some very complicated forms in our web application at work, and I unfortunately can't say what they are, but I can say that
form with fields, tons of fields.
Well, no, not necessarily tons of fields, but checking one checkbox might completely change like three other controls in significant ways. There might be a grid control that might lose some columns and some rows. There might be some other stuff that changes. Really complex business logic with regards to selecting, let's say, plans and options of stuff. But with very arcane business rules, like this combination of this check, of these, radio buttons and this combination of these radio buttons together might actually give you no results on the bottom, because like there's just no combination possible for these things. It's very hard to talk about these things in the abstract because of course I'm not allowed to tell you what I'm developing, but I was thinking like that entire time, like if I can just split out this part of the form and do it entirely in React, I would have a much, much easier time to do it than try to do it with any of the JavaScript data binding things that we have right now. If we have any of the view model E things that we have, to handle our stuff, and keeping the state within the JavaScript in sync with the state and the DOM is such a gigantic headache, especially when you're doing custom controls on top of that stuff, that React in particular was really, really attractive to me, because that thing just re-renders every single time. It doesn't give a shit. It'll be performant because it's going to do the virtual DOM thing, and it's just going to change the DOM components that it needs to do. But to me, it's just a much simpler approach than having to manually sync these things together all the time and having a giant pain in the ass. And then, of course, there are other limitations. Like the thing we're using for view models has I'm going to say partial support for calculated attributes, where we have a lot of math with regards to calculating taxes and stuff like that, which are calculated attributes. The problem is you don't get change notifications for your taxes, or for calculated attributes. You only get them for the non-calculated ones. So you have to manually keep track of all of the dependencies of all of your calculated attributes and then manually re-trigger the rendering of that control. And it's a giant pain in the ass. And, we've been running up against those limits a lot recently. And I just wanted to suggest to my team, like, fuck it. We're just going to use React.js. Fuck that shit. And we didn't do it, of course, because I'm not the boss. I'm not the one who chooses the technologies. I'm just hired help. So it would be a little pretentious of me to actually tell them to screw their framework, but someone else on the team has done that. But it's not me. But yeah. So, there has been a lot of frustration with regards to some of the limitations that I'm running into at work that have caused me to basically be inspired to look out for more, modern ways of doing things. And that led me to discover Redux over the weekend. And that's why I wanted to sort of talk about it, even though it's an imperfect solution, but it's a very interesting one at the very least.
Good. Hey, I'm surprised.
It wasn't about video games.
Right. And I haven't table flipped my table.
Nice. What were you expecting me to say? Because just for a little context, when I told you that we were going to be talking about Model View Controller and possible replacements for Model View Controller, he said he was going to table flip his table during the episode.
I didn't say I would table flip. I will table flip. It's more like I would, depending on what you would say. But yeah, it was fine. And now that I know that it was more related to something that I've run into recently, it's like, okay, yeah, sure.
I mean, ultimately, I try to be pragmatic, and I hope that came out during the episode. I'm still very intrigued by it. I'm going to try it out and probably report on it on a future episode. But yeah, so that's it for this week.
Great. And I'm sure Yannick will put a couple of those libraries links in the show notes.
Yes.
And where could we find the show notes? On our website. Yay! So you can find the show notes of this episode at limitlesspossibility.net/36. You can find also a back catalog of episode at limitlesspossibility.net. You can also find our show on Twitter at @limipo_podcast. That's @limipo_podcast. You can find myself on Twitter at @lucconouche. That's @lucconouche. And you can find Yannick at
Sakurina, SAKURINA.
And I have a small tease for in the next 2 weeks. We will talk about the Apple event next time.
Ooh. What a surprise.
Yeah, that's why I'm teasing it a bit, because it's not a surprise.
All right.
Ba-dum!